Welcome to Education Suspended, a podcast focused on exploring, engaging, and dialoguing with those in education who are passionate about changing the status quo and evolving the archaic system we have inherited.
Hey everyone, Jessica Pfeiffer here. Welcome back to the second Reflective Dissociation episode of season three. Steve and I had a great time just processing and reflecting all of our key takeaways from the last four episodes. It's just such a good experience to realize all that we did absorb and all that we can still learn from the interviews. So just a heads up that this episode will be our last one for a little bit. We're going to move into our summer break, which means we will not be releasing a new episode for the rest of June or July. We'll pick back up in August, and I will let y'all know what date that will be when we decide. But we just want to make sure that we also take some time off to fill our buckets back up, take some time to rest, and get ready to keep giving you all some amazing episodes. So I hope you all have a great summer break. Take time for you, for your friends, for your family, and we will see you when the new school year starts. All right. Love you all. Thanks for listening. Enjoy this reflective dissociation session.
Let's get it going.
We're going. And I'll try not to do too much real extra dissociating today, because to say I'm jet-lagged would be an understatement, Greener.
I think you should tell the team out there where you've been.
Just to recap, we just got back to Iowa. I was working in Prague and then in Oslo, and then we went to Sweden, and then we went to Spain, and we got back about a day and a half ago, and I was feeling really energetic this morning. I called Steve. I'm like, Steve, let's record. And 30 minutes ago, I'm like, I am immediately regretting that decision. I feel a little drunk, so we'll just see how it goes.
That makes two of us.
Perfect. Yeah, yeah, you had a big surgery.
Well, I did. I had my second hip replaced. So now I'm glad I don't have any more hips. But went well. Went hiking the North Woods of Minnesota last weekend.
Jeez, it's crazy how fast they get you up and running.
Yeah. Like 4 hours later, I was doing the 100-yard walk in my hospital corridor and just get it right after it. It hurts too much to stop. So any of you hip surgery people out there, well, you got to be as old as me, maybe, but if you move, you groove. That's what happens. So you just go for it.
Well, I'm glad that you're doing well.
And glad to be back with you, my friend.
I know.
I missed this, and now I don't even know how to dissociate. I do know how to dissociate, actually.
Yeah.
I'm pretty good. But I was thinking of doing this, and I thought, yeah, we're not here to rehash what everybody said, but every one of these guests just triggers something in me.
So let's start. Let's start with, you know, episode 56 was with Zaretta Hammond, and she was one of my bucket listers, right? And I said that in the podcast with her. When we started this podcast of Education Suspended, she was on my short list. I think the work that she's done has been phenomenal, and she's really working hard to fill that theory to practice gap. And it was just such an honor to have her give us her time, her wisdom, and more importantly, her passion. Like, I felt like I was in a Sunday church service, and like, I was just fired up after that interview.
Force of nature is an appropriate meme for Zaretta, right? And then she tied it all to neurodevelopment.
Yeah.
Which of course is up our alley in a big way, but she's way ahead of the game.
Well, and I kept laughing, and it's come up at a couple conferences that I've been teaching at. Like, she gets it. She gets the system that is so like catchphrase after catchphrase. And she's like, you know, you've got schools out there saying, yeah, well, we're brain-based. We do brain-based activities. And she's like, well, what, opposed to kidneys? Like, it's just, she's just so real. And I love it. Anyway.
I loved her theme too. Authentic, really authentic engagement and rigor. And related it all to how easy we all have little microaggressions that affect people who are diverse. And we just have this, as it often says in many of these episodes, yes, I am a old white male, middle class, privileged person. And it is easy to have those kind of microaggressions, even when you're trying to do good.
And she highlights that, but she also does it in a way of like, she makes it safe to have that conversation. because she gives you the science as to why we must tackle it.
Right. And I think what it ended up for me was really centered around the word rigor. We have not purposely in any way shortchanged our kids, but we've been short-sighted in the marvelous intellectual capacities they bring to the table. I mean, I loved it. I learned a lot. I have recommended her to a number of groups of people. If you want a really well-balanced but challenging person, check out Zaretta.
Well, and you're right, that word rigor, because I do think, and I didn't necessarily think about it during the interview, but listening to it again, it was, we make this assumption and we have this narrative that when you graduate, you have learned, you've acquired all this knowledge. And it was just this like raw recognition of, but what really have you learned? What really have you obtained in a way that's transformative? And so that's what I loved about that word rigor that she highlights of like, we've kind of taken out the true skills of creating knowledge seekers.
Exactly. And that was her emphasis on authentic assessment.
Yeah.
Really authentic engagement, I think, was the words she used. Not just assessment. I don't want to be that thin. No, authentic engagement with kids really challenged me as a teacher. And knowing that sometimes when you perceive kids of all kinds as sort of needy or what, in our own microaggressive way, we dumb it down. We don't bring the challenge because we don't find out what is authentic to those kids. And you got to dig. That's hard work for a teacher, but it's so well worth it. What are these kids interested? What can they do? What do they love? Where do they want to go?
I loved how she said, I think she articulated that they come with existing funds of knowledge, but we don't do anything to utilize those funds that they come with. It's such a disservice and so disrespectful to the students.
And I'm going to defend my brother and sister teachers too. When you see 120 to 150 kids a day, how you are supposed to somehow know the nuances of these kids' background is really, really difficult. Which again falls on the system. You should never have 30 kids in a class. It's just, it's untenable.
The system is built for this to happen, for specific funds of experience to be neglected, to be discredited. And it's not rocket science how we've gotten here.
No. The system also doesn't stop us from doing the right thing. And that's what, you know, all the people we interviewed are people doing good rather than just criticizing the bad. They're doing the better. And I think that's one thing all of us teachers can latch onto is the system can't stop us from doing good work.
Yeah. And Zaretta was like epitome. Is that the right word to use? Is epitome a word? Or is that a negative word?
It is a word. Actually, I don't want to launch onto any diatribe about it, but it's a really misused word, actually.
Did I use it wrong?
A lot of people use epitome as the top, the best example of. Actually, epitome really means the average good. Which I actually like better, because we always talk about those people who are on the top. No, the average should be tops.
Yeah.
The average should be good. That would be the epitome of good education, would be where even the average is good.
Yeah. Well, I was saying that, like, I was trying to say for her, like, maybe she's not the epitome. Maybe she is the prime example of someone who is using her passion and doing the hard work.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, powerful. I would encourage anyone to read, even a Google search of Zaretta Hammond will lead you to quotes that will just raise the hair on your arms, and you'll love
it. Okay, well, let's pivot. Our next episode was with Dr. John Conte, and it was to have those two, like to have him follow her. Yeah, I was thinking through it in my mind, you know, like, how does this fit? What is this connection? Because they both focused on educators, right? Like, that was very clear. But his was a little bit more of kind of going back into this world of trauma, which you and I kind of skate around. We don't love that word, but I was, you know, to have someone that's such a world-renowned expert give us their time, it was helpful to hear his insight specifically for me about that, the, what word did he use? Kind of like the collective impact.
Yeah.
Was very, I guess, was one of my major takeaways, like the collective impact that we experience as educators in that system and how that can pan out.
Yeah. John really demystifies the word trauma, doesn't he? If someone wants to listen to someone who says what trauma is and what trauma isn't, he kind of put an end to the buzzword side of the word trauma.
Yeah.
But I like what you said, the collective impact of the trauma in the worlds that we live in the systems that we teach in and the systems that our kids learn in. That was uppermost on his mind.
Yeah. And again, it's not as though, I mean, yes, I think you and I would probably both agree that there are components of actually just school that can be traumatic for specific groups of people. It's not traumatic for everybody. But again, right. his highlight of that collective impact. And I think he also is a kind of like those quiet collective impacts, those things that just kind of happen day in and day out that are these little slights over and over. They have pervasive impacts. And that's why he also said, not about being trauma-informed, it's about being stress-informed, which you and I believe to our core. Like, lose the trauma. If you are in education, you don't understand the impact that stress has on behavior and learning, you can't do it.
Exactly. I love that phrase. And I think I got it from you. The impact of stress. You don't have to say one thing is trauma and one thing isn't. All of our life challenges are stressful. It's how we manage stress. And if you don't understand that as an educator, like you just said, if you don't understand how an open cortex allows learning, but a stress-filled brain does not, you're missing like the golden rule. You're not getting it. You're not understanding how learning happens. And then how trauma, or in our case, really excessive stress affects it. And sometimes we, in our stress-filled lives as teachers, bring on that stress. Then we can look back and realize we too suffer from not being able to handle the stressors of the jobs we're in.
Yeah, and it's just giving everyone permission to move beyond trauma-informed. It's bigger than that. I guess I want to say one more thing. It was helpful for me, and I've been mulling this over a little bit. Actually, I've been mulling this over a lot because I think that you and I'd love to kind of do some collaborative brainstorming on how we can do a better job of training the double-edged sword that is the empathetic connection for educators. The side of the sword that gives us reward, gives us intrinsic pleasure, gets us to work every single day. And yet the side of the sword that can be the strain, that can be the burnout, that can be sometimes this sense of hopelessness that I'm not doing enough, I can't do enough. And it's all about the empathetic connection. It's what gets us into the field. And at the same time, it is what can also get us out of the field. It's just like when he was talking about that, I was like, oh my God, this one thing is so impactful.
It's a blessing / curse. It's light and it's shadow. Then we have to live with both and find the balance. That's why I would rather become community informed. That's what wins. It's community that helps with the side of that sword that is difficult and painful.
Yeah, because if you're going to have teachers year after year, which is how most systems do it, right? You get a new group of students every year, which means that every year you're reinvesting. There has to be a consistent investment from the community and the systems that you can reinvest every year. And that's the lacking piece.
Yeah. Well, then Tracy brought the practical side. I love
Tracy.
I couldn't get enough of that one either. Her ability to explain and expound on the value of understanding sensory integration was marvelous.
Yeah.
Oh, that's such a key piece in classroom management. It's a key piece in understanding kids' ability to, back to what we just said, to handle stressors. It all begins low in the brain, where sensory integration, or taking in sensory information from the outside world and making sense of it, where all that happens. Okay, in the past anyway, we were not taught that as teachers.
And I would venture to say that we're still not really taught that much about it as teachers.
In the same way, Jessica, and again, to not to my shame, I just didn't know, that very much connects to attachment. Yeah. And understanding a child's level of attachment to the human beings who were there when that child was born and into this kind of cold, cruel world, and where sensory information now starts to come through the ears and the nose and the eyes and all of that. And if you're not attached to a loving, caring, connected, attentive human being, that gets wonky. And then you show up in school feeling unattached and sensory information rhythmically not working too well, and you have a kid who'll tear your room apart.
Yeah, I really like that she gave us a little bit of that neuroscience behind the sensory perspective of rhythm and of attachment. Let's talk about it from that occupational therapy lens was awesome. And I think also, I mean, to your point, not only if you show up to school as a student who's, for whatever reason, right, your sensory input is different, the integration piece is off, more often than not, you tend to enter schools that are actually also just developmentally disrespectful for what we want you to be able to do from a sensory perspective from the beginning. And so it's, you know, it's, you're being set up to fail no matter what if you've got some sensory issues, because I think she highlighted so many systems, so many educational systems have really moved away from movement and from rhythm, which are mm-hmm. which she taught us the foundation of becoming regulated to learn.
Exactly. I mean, those things are thought of as in many schools as a waste of time.
Yeah. Or something that you earn, right? It's this extrinsic reward that maybe you can earn the thing that's going to actually get you to learn.
I can't tell you how many times people have said, well, what if I have 10 totally dysregulated kids in a class? I think what would have been Tracy's advice is you get ahead of it. You don't let it get to that point of 10 dysregulated kids, because you begin your class with regulation,
yeah,
with movement, with rhythm, with music, with breath. And you infuse those things into everything you do. And you just watch some of your problems go away.
And you infuse it because you understand the why, right? Again, like really, really appreciated. You're not just doing it because Pinterest tells you to do it. You're doing it because you know the science behind it.
Right.
The last thing about Tracy that I'm looking at all my notes here, and I actually wrote this one down more as a parent. Which is funny because, you know, you can't take off that lens. You get that all the time. She was just highlighting from a systems perspective that in a lot of ways it's in schools, we're asking our children to get regulated before they're developmentally ready. I know she was talking about obviously in the context of classrooms and schools, but you know, I do that sometimes as a parent. My daughter's 3.5 and even on the trip that we just went on there, I needed that reminder because there were times I was expecting her to regulate. I'm like, wait a minute, she's 3.5.
Yeah, exactly.
But we do it all the time with our kids in school, all the time.
Right. The other thing that I wrote down, you know, teachers say, what happens? Okay, I get kids who have had a poor attachment experience. They have a really wonky sensory system. Now, what do I do? One of the answers, I'm not saying it's the answer, you invent ways for active attachment to happen.
Yeah.
You invent ways for kids to work shoulder to shoulder. You invent ways for this movement and music and rhythm to be in team ways. Active attachment, I think, is a real key in overcoming some of the deficits that our kids bring to the classroom. That's not waiting for an explosive thing to react to. No, we're proactive. We build our classroom and our teaching methods around the understanding, you just brought it up, of how the brain works and how attachment works and how sensory integration works. And Tracy brought that to us.
All right. Well, our most recent episode then that we just released was with the two of the three founders of the Windmill School. And I know we talked about it, but essentially, when I was in Colorado, I had the honor of working with Lauren, who was one of the people that we interviewed. And she and her coworkers have developed this school called the Windmill. And that's what that episode was about. Well, I guess I'd say probably maybe 30% of the episode was probably about that school, because most of it, I unfortunately, you couldn't make it because you were having one of your hips ripped out of your body, was talking with them about their experiences as parents. And I think to date, sitting down and meeting with Jackie and Lauren was probably one of my favorite episodes yet, because it just felt different. It felt like the space that we could just kind of process through school as a parent.
Yeah. And I, as I listened to it, I could sense it. I connected to it as a grandparent, both for Lauren. Her description of her work with her daughter, I believe, was so reminiscent of my youngest grandson. And Jackie's own experience as a person with attention deficit reminded me of another one of my beautiful grandsons who, it sounded like we were talking a very similar language, a very similar experience. And so I appreciated listening to them talk about themselves and their parenting, because I felt it as a grandparent. I was just going to run this by you. The whole idea of neurodiversity, obviously, we're all neurodiverse to a degree. We all learn differently. I do understand the more nuanced definition of that, but I see it as a continuum, but I don't see it as a line. I see it as a circle where you can look across the circle and I can see my two grandchildren who are brilliant in their own ways, and they're different than me, but they're brilliant. And I think both moms brought that out, and you did as well. We're looking at a unique experience of a child that no one else has. So how can they not be brilliant at being themselves? That really kind of hit my heart listening to you three talk.
I really like how you said that, because I think even just the visual image of the circle directly connects to kind of what they strongly believe in, of like, there is a difference between inclusion versus just being in the room. Just having access doesn't mean you're truly included. In the circle, that's the inclusionary lens. That's the lens that we are all belong. We are all part of this space. We all have something to offer in this space. And not all schools or educational settings function that way.
And we always think of, well, the neurodiverse kids don't get exposure to the quote, quote, normal kids or whatever you want to call them. I think it's the opposite. I think it's kids not getting exposed to the beautiful gifts of our neurodiverse children who are left bankrupt and not seeing what they could see and understand what they can understand about the diversity of the way people's brains work.
Which is so funny. And I think Jackie's the one that said it, but you know, again, their experience as parents has led them to be two of the three co-founders of this charter school that they're hoping to start, which is the whole premise is true inclusion. And in so many ways, right, it feels kind of revolutionary. It feels like, oh, we're finally doing the right thing. And she's like, this isn't revolutionary. This is exactly what research says we should be doing. And yet so many systems don't do it. You know, it's just ironic to think about it, like something that's like, oh yeah, that makes sense.
There was a phrase, and I think it came from Lauren. I want to say it was Lauren who brought up this idea that we're not here to do things for people. We're here to do things with people. That's true inclusion. And that was a hard lesson for me to learn, even as an older adult, because I can be the, you know, the heroic old white guy. You know, you can fill that role pretty easy. Like, I got to do things for people because that'll relieve my guilt of being the privileged person I am. And then I quickly learned through some experiences with some wonderfully diverse people that I don't do anything for them, but I get to do a lot of things with them. And that's where they're the mutual benefit. I get to look across the circle and see what I can learn from them, even while I'm just being with them. It's not about me giving and them receiving at all.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm glad that you brought that up, because again, that's the difference between what it means just to have access to a space versus actually being included in this space. Access is not what you, it is what you just said, right? Like, you have this implicit bias that you don't even know you have, right? It's the, oh, I'm helping them and they're pushing back. Like, no, inclusion means they help us just as much. Like, this is not one-sided.
No, it's not an exclusive giving at all. And I think that's a hard attitude to get over, though.
Oh, 100%.
In a week or so, I'll be going to Albuquerque, where my daughter and son-in-law work with almost all neurodiverse children and have one of their own. I'm not going there to do anything for them. I say, don't plan anything. Just do your thing. But can I just be included? I just want to go to the farm with them and work on the farm. I want to go to the dance class and dance with them. I'm not going there to do anything for anybody. But I clearly they will do something for me. And that's the inclusive part I think that we're talking about. That's real inclusion, is they are also inviting me into their space.
Amen. These four episodes were so good, and it is fun, even though it took a little getting used to, Grainer, but it is fun when they're actually out and they're live in the ether, right? In the world, to go back and listen to some of them. Months down the road, it's actually helped me professionally, even though I'm one of the people, and I, you know, everyone hates listening to their own voice. I'm like, ah. But it's just so helpful to go back and listen to all these. And before we hit record, I was telling you that last week hit 20,000 listens, which is just mind boggling. And I think in our own right, if this is helping people out there, we're just going to keep doing it. Giving these people in education, giving parents, giving advocates just some free resources to learn. Let's just keep doing it.
It is. It's an inch by inch thing. Well, it takes us right back to the word we almost started with, community.
Yeah. Amen.
We get to be part of a teaching and learning and inclusive community in doing this podcast. That's what every educator, I think, really wants, to be part of that.
We'll wrap up here, but we are recording on June 1st, and it's the beginning of Pride Month. So happy Pride Month to everybody, to my wonderful wife, Krista. I love you, and thank you for letting me do the editing late nights. So we've all got our tribes and our community around us that make this podcast even realistic. So
yes, and Krista really is the best. You know,
I realize that.
You landed.
Yeah, everyone in Europe also thought the same thing. So, all right, everybody. We're grateful for you listening. We're grateful for you sharing, and take care, everybody. Thank you.